Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
To the Wandering DMs channel. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about technology and software that we use in our games. So, Paul, I think the first thing we decided to talk about was, like, what is our earliest experience, or what's the first thing? So,
yeah, you know, actually, Dan, but before we get into that, just one interesting little side note to our viewers. Dan and I met at work, I think, because we worked together briefly as software engineers. So, interesting aspect of us talking about technology and software is that that's actually our background. We were both professional software engineers, and that's how we met.
And it's really, I think that maybe, so, and you, Paul, still work in the video game industry.
Yep.
I'm actually a lecturer of computer science now at a community college here in New York. So I know for me, programming and D&D and gaming were very closely intertwined. And, you know, the more I'd learn about one, the more I'd kind of learn about the other at the same time. Would you say the same thing about that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I feel like they've always been connected for me. I don't know. I think, gosh, I feel like historically they've always been intertwined too, right? Like the earliest adopters of role playing were notoriously, computer scientists and programmers, yeah. Folks, college students who are studying computer science.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. And as I would learn about gaming and learn about, you know, these dice implements that we use, I would be interested in, can I, you know, make a program to just roll dice and, you know, wind up learning more about probability and statistics like that. So I think that's true for many of us. Yeah. So maybe we'll go into the like specific gaming history now.
Sure.
So what was the first earliest software or program that you used for gaming?
I had stuff queued up here in the featured images here, and I think I've accidentally got you queued to go first here. So let me see if I can pull this off. Okay, there we go. Boom! That was my first software, was the Dungeon Master's Assistant. I was totally obsessed with all the Goldbox SSI games back in the day. So this looked an awful lot like one of those, but it wasn't. You know, it was like a DOS, or I think in this case it looks like maybe it's a Commodore 64 box, of a text-based tool for generating. I think you could generate like encounters with it. You could say, I want, you know, use these random charts and my party is this level, go. I don't know. It wasn't great, to be honest. It was not very good software.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for many, many years, many of us were frustrated by, like, the promise of those kinds of products.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
The third edition Player's Handbook actually came with a disc.
Yep.
When I got it in the back of the Player's Handbook, actually, with the promise of a similar product that would be improved, and I used that for a while, and it was slightly frustrating.
I want to think that, from what I remember that software, the main thing I thought that, like, you got out of it was that it did have a character generator, which was, okay, but still not really as good as paper and dice.
That is exactly what I would say, exactly the same thing, yeah.
I would argue that nobody really hit the nail on the head until D&D Beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Now, not that I've used that, but you've praised it very highly, and
yeah.
Seem like someone finally got it right.
I use it in all the 5th edition games I've played. We've used D&D Beyond. It just works. So that's what you need. It just works. So
great.
Well, how about you?
Yep.
Sorry, I was going to ask, bring us back around. So what was the earliest software you used?
Okay, so for me, slightly earlier, back in the day in Dragon Magazine, before there was really any way of distributing software, you actually did have these code listings. And so like the first one I could find was in 1980, and they actually had an ongoing series called The Electric Eye. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing on the screen right now is, I think, from 1981, 1982, a code listing for Dungeon Master's Personnel Service, which is to create player characters, in this case for basic D&D, and that's a code listing in BASIC intended for TRS-80 computers, actually. So I apologize to all the Commodore 64 fans. the first computer that I was a TRS-80 guy, I was a color computer guy, which is what my first computer was. And so this particular code listing goes on for, I think, about 4 full pages. And at the time, we just didn't have any other choices. You had to sit down and you had to type the whole thing in.
Yep.
And it looks kind of ridiculous, but I mean, there were magazines for the TRS-80 every month that were nothing but that. So some of us were kind of accustomed to that. So I think that thing right there was probably the first thing I sat down and typed in its entirety for character generation, to quickly make PCs or possibly NPCs. And in that case, that was basic BX D&D. So the obvious next thing was, wait a minute, I'm a sophisticated advanced D&D player. Shouldn't I have an AD&D character generation system? And how about I go and make that? And then you find out how horrible multiclassing is.
Yep. Yep. That sounds about right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that many of us, like so many of us, have made a character generator or a treasure generator or a random, you know, dice roller or things like that. And it's like among the first, like if we made a D&D and software class, that would be like among your day one exercises.
Yeah, for sure. I know there's a lot of great ones online, right? I'm thinking of like donjon.com. Like, am I saying it right? I don't know if it's just dungeon.com, but donjon.com.
Yes.
Has a ton of great stuff.
Right.
I'm also pretty partial to, that's definitely, I'm looking it up as I say it out loud, and that is definitely not the URL. That's something totally different. Don't go there, people. donjon.bin.sh is, in fact, the website. Full of your sort of automated versions of various tables. Yeah. I'm personally partial to Inspiration Pad Pro, put out by Enboss. Mm-hmm. They have a nice little shorthand for writing your own tables as quickie text files. So I've posted to my blog a couple times where I've taken tables and converted them for use in Inspiration Pad Pro. That also has the ability to like add a couple variables or do some blah blah blah. Eventually, I pushed that all the way to the point at some point to actually generating full on characters, which is probably about as complex as that thing can get.
Yeah, that's a good tool. Certainly, I think like in the third edition era, like I made a library specifically so you can pull any tool out of third edition's SRD and like automatically roll on it. Mm-hmm. That's what I did at one point. Yeah. I think that was in Pascal.
That's funny. I mean, eventually I myself got sick of that. It wasn't easy enough to maintain or whatnot, so I wrote eventually my own Python code for generating characters using all my house rules and all the stuff I wanted to use. Originally I was doing BX, eventually I converted to OED, and that's actually posted on my blog. You can go and generate some characters on my blog if you want.
So I guess that's a good segue into our second topic of what have you and I created. Mm-hmm. So now you have your custom PC generator that's on your blog, which is fantastic. What else do you have currently that you are happy to use?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big one. I use that forever to generate my pre-gens for all my convention games. I played a lot with that one in sort of PDF form filling, so I would use Scribus to create a form fillable PDF of the character sheet I wanted, and then use that program, the Python program I wrote, to generate and to automatically fill out that PDF, so you'd have a nice formatted PDF of a character sheet.
I gotta say, the first time I saw that, I like went, holy crap, that is amazing. The first time I saw the automatically generated fancy PDF filled out, I was like, oh my god, I must learn how to do that, because I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, that one came out really organically, honestly. I started with just, I want my own character sheet and I want it to be PDF form fillable, so how do I make one of those? And then I made a tool that like would generate the character and I was transcribing it. And I'm like, this is dumb. How do I automate this?
Yeah.
Let's see. Let me think of what else have I written. I made a geomorph painter.
Right.
right? And that's I think Dyson Logos and some other artists online, OSR artists, were generating a lot of really great, like Rhizus Monkey. A bunch of them were making these really great and interchangeable geomorphs that they were posting onto their blogs. And I just wanted something easier than a full-on paint program, something that would just let me stamp them down real quick and export a map. So that's also posted on my blog.
And you also have an example on your blog of actually using it quickly to actually generate a dungeon in a couple of steps, which I thought was a really fascinating look behind the screen about how you actually use that stuff.
Yep, that's one of my favorite things, honestly, too, these days. I sort of recognize that, like, I'm not an artist. I'm not going to create a gorgeous map. And to be honest, like, that's one more creative piece I have to do in creating a dungeon that I can offload. So if I can just find a good enough looking map or one that's sort of pseudo random generated and start with that, that saves me a lot of time when I'm building dungeons.
Right, very nice.
Yeah. What else? What about you? What have you written?
Okay, so for me, so my general shtick is I really like, for game balancing purposes, I'm fond of simulating a whole game in software, being able to run it a billion times, and gets to, which some people would refer to as a Monte Carlo simulation, but in my head it's just like actually do the thing. And get statistics about whether it's, you know, how often people can win or lose or die or succeed or stuff like that. So that's actually something that I've, like, given a talk about at Johns Hopkins a couple of years ago in a game development class they have there. So over the years, like, I've simulated D&D combat, D&D archery, Star Frontiers spaceship battles, Bismarck ship battles, and I've also actually simulated the Game of Life for my partner Isabel's immigration Game of Life project. So the biggest thing I have is on my GitHub, which is GitHub / Daniel R. Collins 1. I have this suite that I call Arena, which basically simulates D&D mostly melee combat. And so I've used that to get demographics information about how many people of a certain level should exist in a D&D world in the Arena program. I have a monster metrics application to estimate strength and XP value of all the monsters in original D&D.
Okay.
I've got an NPC generator to spit out PCs and NPCs and hirelings. And then I also have a program called Marshall to spit out, like, the big wilderness groups that you get in D&D of bandits and brigands and buccaneers and stuff like that. And the neat thing, what I love about that is that my Marshall program for that, all the high-level leaders actually have their entire career simulated. So in my games, when you run into, like, a group of bandits and they have an 8th-level fighter leader, theoretically, I could go back and I can actually report on every single fight that that leader had to get to 8th level.
Excellent.
So I'm kind of fond of that. So that's the kind of thing. So I'm particularly, I do like having this Arena software to report on monster levels and use that as a library for spitting out lots of characters when I need to do that. So that's definitely the biggest thing when people ask me, what have I done? I wind up pointing them at that Arena suite, which is in Java, and I keep updating it, and it's taken a couple of years, and I'm actually really happy with the results that, that show up in my games as a result of that.
Great.
Yeah.
Let's shift to the side a little bit and talk about hardware.
Okay.
Is there any hard technology hardware that you in particular use these days, either when running or when preparing for a game?
That's a great question. No. And I've always been a software guy for a couple of reasons. So I don't tend to think about the hardware that much. Even the camera that I'm currently using here is, like, partly, you know, your recommendation, actually. So I'm usually following other people's recommendations. I have a Windows 7 PC. When I come to the game table, all my stuff's on paper.
Okay.
What about you, Paul?
So I generally really like paper. Usually I find I desperately want to use technology at the game table, and it always kind of lets me down. I would say, in fact, one of the biggest I think most important technology investments I've made towards my gaming is to get a good printer that can print double-sided so that I can print booklet format stuff. And I even treated myself to a deep-throated stapler so that I can staple those booklets, you know, at the halfway mark that'll you know, take a 5.5-inch sheet of paper to get the staple in there.
That's an interesting point because, you know, I'm always skeeving off the school copiers. I'll do double-sided booklet, whatever. Probably I shouldn't have said that, but having that at home would be really nice.
It's pretty nice. You know, and a lot of OSR folks really like the booklet format. I love the booklet format simply because, again, I can print it out physically at home.
That's my top reason too.
Let's go back to our feature images here. So, a while back when netbooks were a thing, I thought for sure this is it. This is what's going to get me to have a computer at the table. So this is a picture of my first netbook. If anybody remembers that, a sort of pre-tablet era kind of technology there. And I spent a lot of time sort of digitizing and wikiifying a module to see if it could take the place of the physical module. It turned out to be awful. I hated it after a while. Recently, and we'll see this next weekend when we do our live cast of our actual game, I hooked up a projector to my ceiling. So that's the sort of the fanciest bit of technology that I've got going now. So that projector points down at the table, and then I have a laptop next to me that I can load up a screen on, and I can push an image to it with a map or whatever, and it'll project down onto the tabletop for use with miniatures or whatnot. And I actually now that I think about it, I wrote some custom software to go along with that. I wrote a really rinky-dink, I'm sure that there's existing software that does this better, but I wrote a real rinky-dink thing that would just open the same image in two windows with a black mask over it. And then in one window, you can sort of paint away, reveal parts of the photo, and then the other window will mimic that. So it's sort of basically you have your GM view and your player view, and the GM view can see the whole map, but also can see where you're painting visibility, and the player map is just black, except for where you've revealed.
That ends up really nice. So I played with that for the first time last 4th of July, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that again this weekend when we live cast our actual play. And it's really sweet. It doesn't get in the way of the play. We leave our miniatures just set up on the grid there, and extra parts of the dungeon appear. And I usually, at least last year, I have the paper and I was documenting it on the map.
Well, that's what I was using it for, really. So I still really like mapping. I don't want to use a lot of miniature-based combat. I don't think we even really did, right? We often usually didn't have miniatures for the bad guys on the table.
I agree.
But it was nice for. A lot of times I find when I'm describing the physical location of where you're exploring and the other person's mapping, sometimes I'll get hung up on really weird, unusually shaped, and then the game can kind of grind a little bit because we got to figure out, I got to explain to you what it is that you see and use my best words, and you're trying to interpret
and
what
I'm saying.
And
that totally just happened to be like Friday night. I mean, all that, you know, I have a bunch of weird kinked up trapezoidal rooms, and that exact thing happened.
Yeah, and then sometimes I'll just break down and be like, "Look, I'll just draw something for you. Here you go." And then I have something to draw and say, "Look, it's kind of shaped like this." This removes that. I don't know. There's something to be said, I think, for not having it, for saying, "Oh, theater of the mind," and just, you know, that's part of it. Is you don't have perfect measuring tools when you're drawing a map.
Yeah, there was a big debate on the original D&D forums about that a while back of some people saying what we're saying right here, we'd prefer to not have that in the way of the play. And then one of the original Gygaxian players starting to screaming in all caps, like, no, that's the biggest, most critical, essential part of the game is getting the players confused with your descriptions. I'm not totally sold on that myself.
I can't say I feel strongly enough one way or the other to make like a really impassioned statement here. I think they both have their pros and cons. So this was kind of gratuitous part. I just wanted to see if I could do it. There was just the challenge of can I really stick a freaking projector on the ceiling? And then the funny thing is too, then like as you're playing, I'm revealing parts of the map, but then as you moved on, I would just replace it. I didn't like, there was no, if you wanted a physical remnant map to remember, you still have to draw it.
Right. Right. Which was entirely our responsibility to document that. And yep. I thought it worked really super well.
Yeah.
I really love having that projector there actually.
So yeah. So we'll use that again this coming weekend and cool. Our viewers can check it out and decide for themselves whether they think it's great or terrible.
Cool. I vote for great.
I will say, let me just once more talk about, actually, before I move on, is there any other physical technology you want to talk about?
No, that's it. You know, I considered, like at one point I had a tablet, and you know, the other thing I like for the digest format is that it works well on a tablet.
Yeah.
Actually. And I've gotten away from bringing that. Like I used to bring a tablet just like in case I had to look up in the monster manual or something like that. And I've gotten away from that. It would, you know, it would always take too much time away from the table. Yep. And I think I'd prefer to just like improvise my best recollection of something.
Yep.
So nowadays I don't have anything there that's not on paper.
Yeah. You know, that's my rule of thumb when running, any system. And I've been repeating this to a lot of folks because of my 5th edition West Marches game that I've been running, because there's a lot of players, but I keep saying, I refuse to lose game time to flipping through books. Mm-hmm. I'll have the book there. If I can quickly find it, fine. But if it takes more than like 2 or 3 seconds, I'm just going to make something up and I'm probably going to get it wrong and that's fine. We're going to move on. And later you can look up the right answer and tell me all about it. And next time, hopefully I'll get it right.
Yeah. And I 100% agree with that. For me, pacing's the number one thing to the best that I can manage it. And not everybody agrees with that. I've seen 5th edition players that said, I'm playing 5th edition because I want the rules to be right. And we're going to spend any arbitrary amount of time looking it up. And I'm on the other side of that.
Yeah, me too. Now, I will say, and maybe this is a good segue into like what other people's software technology are using. These days, I am using D&D Beyond for any of the 5th edition games I'm playing or running. And I think it's amazing. It's wonderful. I've played as a player with a tablet in front of me, and it's crazy because suddenly, like, I don't even have a pencil in front of me anymore. I just have a tablet, and I think my opinion is that they probably optimized that thing for tablet. That's like, it's like, phone is a little too small, and laptop's a little too big and bulky, and tablet is perfect.
Interesting.
And it's automated all the nitty-gritty details, of which 5th edition has a fair amount.
Yeah.
Without getting too editorial there, there's a fair amount of stuff that I don't have to know because I can just say, okay, character sheet, short rest. It'll ask me a couple questions. I say yes or no, and it takes care of it.
And so you're talking about like recording damage and conditions and healing, all that kind of stuff.
Yep. 5th edition has a lot of stuff around the concept of short rest and long rest. Short rest being an hour, you get some of your abilities back, and long rest being obviously like the day change. Every class has like, and this resets and this resets in that way, and there's a lot of specific stuff. And you don't have to know any of it. Like that's my favorite bit of automation, honestly. In theirs, they do have other automation, like you said, of like record that you have this condition, what's it mean, or I guess even if I'm like looking at my spell list and I say I want to cast a spell, I can click on it and have the description of the spell right in front of me. All of that just, it's fast enough and easy enough that it kind of finally fulfills that promise of the computer is actually better than paper and books and shuffling.
Interesting. Now, when I've asked you before, like you've said, that's something that seems necessary for 5th edition because of the complexity level, but probably not for original D&D. Would we need the same thing?
I think that's true. I mean, for players, right, I mean, you barely have anything. Here's a weird thing. I don't know if this falls in this category or not, but spells, right? Probably the most complicated thing you have in front of you as a player in OED is spells.
Right.
And so you've made some booklets, which you hand out. And so here it is, just at your fingertips. And then I reformatted that and produced cards. And so some players play with cards. And that's, again, it's just sort of like trying to get the minimal thing, physical thing in front of you that is the fastest to quickly look at, right? Well, I guess the nice thing about the cards is that it lets you whittle down to just the spells you care about.
Yeah, you're right.
Right. Yeah. Here's a deck that's my spell book. I'm going to pluck cards that are what I've memorized today, and now I don't even have to worry about the rest of this stuff. It's just what I know in my hand.
Right. And for me, there's part of a like echoing the, you know, without going full LARP, I have sometimes argued in favor of echoing the in-game action with the at-table action. So I have kind of been fond for the wizard characters with their spell books being reflected by the wizard players with being the ones that have to have a book that they're flipping through the pages kind of in a similar fashion. That having been said, when you made the deck of spells and I offer the two options at the table, inevitably everybody takes the deck of cards. So that has been a totally unanimous preference of the players. And so I bring, you know, a couple decks of cards to the table myself nowadays.
I think it works especially well because of your house rule of you can only memorize any given spell once, right? So you're... Every card is a one-to-one. This is a spell that I have in my head, right? You have one card for every single spell memorized. And then the physicality of it, like I cast Strength on you, or I cast, I don't know, some other, whatever other spells you can cast on someone. Here's the card. You hold it.
Yeah, we discovered that's a really nice aspect of when that happened Friday. Not that we're using cards, but the wizards are casting protection on the fighters, and the fighters don't know what that means. Here's a card, and now you know what that means.
I've even gone so far as to do it sometimes with magic items. If somebody has a magic item that replicates some spell effect, I'll just pluck the card out. Here you go. Here's the Here's the spell that's on that scroll, or comes out of that wand, or what have you.
Great. That's a good point too.
Diverged a little bit from technology. So,
paper's technology, writing's a technology.
Fair enough. So I don't think you really need, I think the most complicated thing the player has is spells, possibly like inventory management. I could imagine writing some software that lets you like plunk down what's exactly in your inventory and automatically calculates your encumbrance or something for you. But even that feels pretty heavy handed. On the DM side, let me go back in fifth edition on the DM side. I usually have my laptop open and I have a couple tabs of a browser open. One is specifically to the monsters, so I can quickly just type the name of a monster and pull them up. And then I usually have another tab maybe for a quick lookup of spells, and then maybe a third one that they just have a general search feature, a la Google, right? Where you're just like, search everything in fifth edition for this term. And it's reasonably good, so it's usually for that. It's rules reference for faster than flipping through the very fat 5th edition books.
Okay, interesting. I guess for me, I'm still in the mode of my software is for pre-planning and preparation.
Yeah.
And I'm maybe even further away from thinking about using digital stuff at the table. So my stuff's all pre-planning. Now that we're talking about it, like if I could pick one thing at the table, I wind up spending some amount of time rolling for like wilderness encounters. Like, did the encounter happen? What table is it on? Is it in a lair? How many are they? How far away they are? And that winds up being a little bit of a gap when an encounter shows up. So I suppose if I had a one button press for what encounter just showed up and could start running it, I guess that's the thing I might pick second.
If it looked real slick too, I could just imagine you've got your laptop open, you have a little picture of like five hexagons of terrain with the different terrain types in them, and you're like, oh, I'm gonna click on mountains. Boom.
Yeah,
tells
you're right.
You the weather, tells you the monster, or whether or not you found anything.
This is dangerous because I had I had another friend that I said the dangerous part is saying like I'm not gonna do this, but if I did, here's how I do it. As soon as I say that, like you wind up doing it, right? You lock me in. So I'm not gonna talk about that anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
So what stuff do you use from other people's? We kind of talked about like what we've written for ourselves. What stuff do you use that fills in gaps?
I talked about Inspiration Pad Pro. That's probably my number one go-to, partly because also it goes on my phone. So I have a copy of that on my phone with my custom tables loaded into it. So if like I need a name real fast, pop that sucker open. And that's real nice, again, because it's on the phone, so it's very small. It just takes up very little table space sitting there, and it's always in my pocket anyway because my phone's always in my pocket. So I use that. What else? Not thinking of anything. You?
So the main thing, like one thing that I really like is there's a program called Hexographer, and I guess with version 2, they've renamed it to Worldographer technically, but when I'm using it, what shows up for me is Hexographer, and that's a program written by a guy named Joe Wetzel, and it makes wilderness maps in old school BX, hex, iconographic style. Mm-hmm. And I think it's exactly what I want for making hex maps. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple different options, and you can label them or not label them. It has a, you know, randomizer, which I don't use. One of the really nice things is you can bring up an underlay of another map. So if I make a map possibly by hand or I'm getting it from somebody else, you can bring it up as an underlay and then paint in the actual hexes over it,
yep.
which I've used many, many times.
Yep.
So all my wilderness maps are like that, and you can key particular things to DM view only and then print out a version without those things for the players. So this Hexographer or Worldographer is definitely my silver bullet for making wilderness maps. Now it is, you know, it's hex-based, which I like, because I like having the hexes to be gameable. It's not designed to make a nice perfectly fractal, you know, perfectly topographic map, but that's not what I want anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So for my wilderness stuff, Hexographer is a major tool that I use. For dungeons, I actually, in the past, I made a Windows program called GridMapper, which is kind of like Hexographer, except just for square grids, kind of like the ones behind you right now, Paul. very simple. I still have it on my website. I haven't updated it in a while back. Weirdly, apparently the crochet community started picking up my grid mapper, and started using that to plan out crochet patterns before they'd actually knit them together.
And
I had a couple, like I don't, it doesn't even have color in it, but so I had a couple of requests to add color for the crochet people in my grid mapper program. So I've kind of gotten, I've kind of gotten away from that, and now I just use GIMP. I actually just use GIMP for my dungeon creation now, in kind of similar ways. But anyway, the point is, I want something that I can just paint, you know, the grids either open or closed.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, I kind of use GIMP for that, and then I can use a bunch of other stuff for that too.
Okay.
But I do highly recommend Hexographer or Worldographer. It's really been great for me.
Yeah, I've used that in the past. In fact, I wrote a video game way back when, a mobile game that took place on a hex map,
right?
And we actually used Hexographer as our level editor.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
We dug into his data format and then just said, "Oh, this is perfect. This is just what we need."
Oh.
And
Oh, that's great. What language did you write that in?
Let me think. What was it written in Java? Because it was it was written using a framework called libgdx, which is a Java game framework that works on various mobile platforms, Android and iOS specifically. So.
Okay, so here's some inside baseball. Is the library that reads the Hexographer format of open source available?
We never open sourced our code.
Okay.
But the Hexographer, I think their format's just XML.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think you just.
But still, I assume you had to do some kind of like parsing the XML format, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
There's a lot of good XML libraries out there. And I think he probably just obfuscates it, right? He probably just changes the file extension. But I think if you just turn it to .xml, you'll find out. Yep, it's just XML.
All right. Okay. I just learned something. That's great. Interesting.
Oh.
You know, the other thing I'm going to say is, frankly, you know, the internet is a great tool.
Yeah.
Right. So when I started gaming, like in the 80s, I was writing a whole bunch of stuff on a typewriter, right, that no one else in the entire world was ever going to see.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, the internet became a possible thing. Not everybody's going to think about, like, that as being an option nowadays, like that maybe you didn't have. But I went for a long time writing a whole bunch of stuff that no one else in the entire world was ever going to see because there wasn't any way to communicate it. So the fact that we have the internet now to communicate, put on a website, make a blog, make a Twitter, is I'm never going to get over how amazing and cool that is.
Yeah, I suppose some of us take that for granted, but
yeah.
Yep. I mean, there's certain things, all right, like you mentioned the GIMP, which I also use for image editing. It's open software, so it's freely available on a variety of platforms. I never could be bothered to learn Photoshop, and nor am I going to pay for it. But yeah, I don't know. Is that a gaming tool, or is that just a computer use tool that, I don't know, I use a computer.
Yeah. That one's kind of borderline, but for me nowadays, GIMP is my dungeon creation tool. And that's for me, at least, that's how I mostly think about it.
Yeah. I mean, in a similar light, I definitely recommend Scribus if you're like, I super want to make a form fillable PDF, super good at that. Really easy to sort of, if you already had some image or something, bring that in as a layer and then just start drawing boxes on top of it and export it out as a PDF.
And I've been using OpenShot lately for some videos that we put up on Wandering DMs, and I'm sure everybody has their own preferred video editing software. But for me, it was very, very easy to get into it. And, open source and free, which I like, so.
Right. I mean, of course, we'll have I think actually what prompted this discussion was we're thinking about next weekend coming up, and we're going to live cast our game. And so, of course, my table upstairs is now chock full of microphones and cameras and all kinds of other tech. There's certainly all that stuff.
Excellent. So I've asked this before. Have you had the chance to run a game with the setup there?
I haven't. I haven't had the chance to get enough people around the table to do a reasonable sort of sound check. Okay. So we'll be.
See, I feel like that adds an extra level of excitement. Right, because in addition to the actual game, it's going to be completely without a safety net, debugging and checking and trying to make that stuff run, which I'm happy to help with.
Yeah.
So there's kind of an extra level of risk.
Yep.
I mean, beyond just the standard TPK.
It's set up. It's using the same software we use for this cast, which is OBS. So. Should be all right. I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
I'm really looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to seeing how that comes off. I love the way that we play, so I'm happy to share it with other people.
Yeah, our first evening is always a little rock and roll anyway, right? Because you guys drive up from New York, so you're a little toasty from all the travel, and then typically in the past we've had to do character creation. We won't do that, I guess, this year. Instead, we'll waste a bunch of time trying to figure out the tech.
Yeah.
Will we get any actual gaming done in Thursday night? Maybe. I guess we'll find out.
I bet we'll do something.
We're usually pretty aggressive about getting a game.
Yeah. So maybe for the last thing, are there any gaps or other technology that you really wish that we had available that we don't at the moment?
Yeah, I got asked a kind of similar question professionally when I was on a panel with a bunch of folks who had all made Star Trek video games, which is why I have behind me the image of the holodeck. Which I kind of think is the ultimate expression in what we hope someday video games will become, right? What everybody wants is the Star Trek holodeck. That's, I think, all gaming, tabletop video games or whatever, are all leading us to, when can we have the holodeck, please? right? I mean, that's what we want. Come on. The thing I keep waiting to see solved is I've done some online games. I've done some games through Google Hangouts where people aren't physically present. And to this day, physical presence is just better, right? Like, you can have a game online with everybody calling in. It works. It's just not quite as good. And I'm curious to see if technology will ever be able to get over that hump.
Yeah, interesting. What is your guess, if you had to take a stab?
What's my guess of will it? Oh, I'm sure it will. It's just a question of in my lifetime or not. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yep.
I think I would guess possibly not.
Yeah.
I think I would guess possibly not. I think, I think there'll always be something about being present personally that's a little bit better.
Right. But if you had holodeck level simulation of presence, right, where I can't even actually tell the difference between you are in fact physically present or you are not, what are you missing?
I think my theory in the past has been the bugs will always be different. They'll always be,
bugs.
Is that there will always be either a bandwidth or a bug or a, we lost the connection, yep. Which is going to be different from live bugs like I'm sick and I've infected you or like I smell bad.
So,
right.
A couple of video games. So there's a bit of a tangent here, but I think it's worth talking about because it's gaming related and it's technology related. A couple of video games have attempted to make a quote unquote DM mode, right? If you remember this, I know certainly Neverwinter Nights is famous for having done it. There was, I think before them, there was a vampire game that tried to do it.
Okay.
Anyway, the idea being, right, that here's a computer role-playing game where you're going to play your typical computer role-playing game, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But there's a special mode, a multiplayer mode, where one person is promoted to DM, and they have powers where they can, like, spawn bad guys and generally have, like, sort of admin-level control over the world. And it's, I think, personally, it's always, I've been super excited about it, and it's always been bad. Specifically because, like, it's just not reactive fast enough, right? I cannot spawn in a couple of direwolves into this cave that you happen to decide to explore fast as I can at a, like, tabletop where I can just narrate, you see some wolves, right?
Okay.
Like, boom, done. Anyway, why did I go down this path? Now I totally lost my train of thought. Why did I start talking about DM? We were asking about whether or not telepresence will ever 100% get there and fill that gap. Right. So, that's never... I feel like that kind of gameplay always fails. And you were talking about the bugs, right? So, there's a famous story or anecdote on the internet somewhere about don't roleplay the bugs, where a group was trying to play this in Neverwinter Nights. They were trying to, like, find that tabletop-like experience, but with Neverwinter Nights, where one player's playing the DM. And one of the players keeps, like, howling and barking and, like, just behaving really erratically. And the other players are like, what are you doing, dude? Knock it off. Let's go kill these kobolds or whatever. And they finally realizes he's saying, like, oh, well, no, I'm a werewolf, right? Like, I'm just role-playing this, that I became a werewolf. And everybody's like, what are you talking about? And it turned out to be a bug. That a bug that was rendering his character as a dog.
So he's
seeing this dog and thinking, like, oh, something happened. And the GM literally said, stop role-playing the bugs! Stop role-playing the bugs. Yeah, there will always be bugs. You're right. There will always be bugs.
Yeah. And I think that's something we, you know, that's great. What a great anecdote.
Don't role play the bugs.
And I think the bugs will be different. I think whatever platform you're on, you're going to have slightly different bugs, and you will be able to detect that.
And they will break things in a way that real human interaction doesn't.
So as far as like possibly other gaps, you know, so I was looking at these early Dragon Magazine basic programming listings, and you have the PC generator, and you have written your own PC generator, and I've written my own PC generator, and historically I've written about three. I don't know how many PC generators have you written over the years?
A lot.
Yeah.
Let's just say a lot.
So a lot. So obviously, that's the pinnacle of, like, things we want to see in software, right? We all want that, and we all want exactly the thing. So the earliest listings in Dragon I could find, and I think this is issue 34 or something like that. There's three short listings, and one is a time tracker.
Yep.
And one is a royalty generator, and one is a town generator. And my current top thing that I wish I had was a town village generator. And specifically small village. I'm not talking about a big walled city that has blocks of streets. Not talking about that. I'm talking about a little village like the village of Hamlet or something like that that's mostly open.
There's one online. I'm trying to pull it up from my memory here.
I've searched so many, and this is great for cities, right? This is what you're looking at right here is the total silver bullet for cities, and I use that and it's wonderful.
Right.
And I've searched, and I've even asked on. There's a forum on Reddit called RPG Generators.
Yep.
Right. And I've actually asked on there in the hopes that someone had one or would make one, and basically there's nothing to solve that problem to my satisfaction.
So you're talking about something on the scale of a Hamlet or a Restenford that's going to not only be that scale, but have that level of detail, I assume. This is where so-and-so lives. They're related to these people. They have these children.
Yeah. Or at least like, here's an inn, here's a blacksmith, here's a trader.
Yep.
Right, the stuff that PCs would be interested in would be wonderful.
Yep.
With a one button click, and you can have 100 of these in your campaign world without a whole lot of effort. In the past, I actually tried to use the original SimCity for that, but you got to spend hours, making a single one. Yeah, and they had a medieval art pack that you could attach to it that I was using for a while. But I really want something with one button press click. So the funny thing is that, my need right now is exactly, one of the things they were trying to do with a basic town generator back in 1980. That was totally one of the first things that they had there. So the needs seem to be very consistent across the years and decades. So if anybody has a random Village of Hamlet style generator, please add that in a comment or tell us about that, because I've been hunting and haven't found quite the right solution to that yet, and I'm really trying not to spend the time to write it myself.
I want to think that there was a recent module reviewed on Fear of a Black Dragon that was sort of the adventure is you go to this town and you investigate the weird spider called in the town. But when you get the module and read it over, you realize that it's actually like a generator for a town like that. And I haven't looked at it myself, and I wish I could remember the name off the top of my head, which I can't, and I'm sure I'll go look it up after this and find out. But I don't think it quite goes to the level of and mapping it out.
I want a map to be able to show the players.
Yeah.
Right. I would like a similar to your projector application. I would like to be able to visualize it immediately to the players. I do want something that spits out a map.
Yeah. I usually end up just stealing that stuff. I've used Restenford time and time again. And guess what? Next weekend, you guys are getting Restenford as your home base. That's what we used last year. I don't know if you realized it, but.
I don't think I did.
Yeah.
I need to visualize it. If I saw it, I would immediately say, "Oh, I know what that is."
Yeah.
And up until that point, I tend not to be able to recognize that.
Cool. Well, there you go. I think generators are certainly an obvious thing to. It's the stuff that's tedious, right? You look at what is the work that I'm doing to prep for a game that is tedious. How can I automate that?
And for things that come in large numbers.
Yep.
So. Possibly hirelings, PCs particularly for a tournament game, possibly treasures, big groups wandering in the wilderness like bandits and brigands. And of course, in the earliest original D&D, you had to buy a product, right? There was a product called the Rogue's Gallery that was just like a 50-page product of random NPCs and random bandits.
Yep,
was the only option at the time. And for me, I'm realizing that I should have lots and lots of villages in my campaign, and I don't want to spend time making 100 of those.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And then I would say for at the table stuff, generally I want either fast rules look up, right? That's what I use D&D Beyond for, is I don't want to spend time flipping pages, because the funny thing is, I think I don't need that for OED because the books are so short. It's very easy to flip the pages. Whereas in 5th edition, every monster gets like 5 freaking pages of text, and I don't have time to flip through that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like, oh, and do you have this supplement, that supplement? No, geez, no. Right. It's sort of the monstrous compendium problem, right? That the sort of, oh, we'll give you a binder and you can slip pages in, except when they don't fit. And ugh, yuck.
Well, you know, the funny thing is we played a couple of Marvel superheroes games here recently, like one or two or three. And they released all the in the 80s, they released all the superheroes and all the villains in that same monstrous compendium format. So I have these, and you saw that at the Total Con game.
Yep.
That we played in. And so, you know, like, I actually last Wednesday, I was like, I have a much better way of organizing my binders. And I spent a day and a half organizing my binders of Marvel superheroes. And at the end of it, I was like, I don't know, that was a bad idea.
Yeah.
And if it was on software, you could immediately, you know, sort it however you wanted. So that would be a really nice solution to that.
Yeah. So that, and then rules automation, which I think generally we don't need a lot of in OED, certainly not on the player side. You know, and it's just easy enough to do, I think, on the DM side with physical artifacts.
Yeah.
But in fifth edition, that's the thing I like the most, is just if it's at my fingertips and literally faster than me, like, trying to remember and do math or what have you.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I guess I should say, you know, based on our prior henchman video on Friday, in my Friday campaign game, one of my players came in and said, I'm convinced I want henchmen.
Nice.
Which I was surprised about, right?
Yep.
And so I had to, so it flipped to my page where I had a bunch of pre-made hirelings, and they did the advertising and were doing the negotiation. And one of my other players say, I'm kind of amused at the idea of, like, at the end of every game, Dan goes home and has to spend a couple nights rolling up a bunch of hirelings. And I quipped, but we have programs for that now. And we have since 1980.
Yep. There you go. All right. Well, that's about all I have. Do you have any final thoughts on software technology?
That's it for me. I think if there's something that we overlooked, someone should leave a comment and we can do a follow-up video about the thing you were interested in that we didn't touch on. But it's certainly my understanding of gaming is all wrapped up in my understanding of programming, and a lot of the time me learning new programming or math has been totally predicated on me understanding our games better.
Yeah, there's sort of the dichotomy there of, like, you know, the mother of in necessity is the mother of invention, right? Sort of like, I need a thing, so I guess I'll write a program to do it. And then the flip side of to the man with a hammer, every problem is a nail. So unfortunately, I've definitely fallen into that trap and, like, written a lot of software just because, like, oh, can I solve this with software? Let me find
out. Yeah, same
sometimes,
thing.
Sometimes a number two pencil is just fine. Just fine. I guess I agree with you on the village thing. I think David Heron has posted that he would like that as well. I think that's what he's talking about there. Get to work, Dan. Tell us when you have that village generator ready for us.
Dang it.
I could use it.
I've done it again. Rats. Thank you, David, for that. So if you have any other comments, are you good, Paul?
That's it. I think like Dan said, please leave comments in our YouTube video. Let us know what software you've used. Is there stuff that we're overlooking that's super awesome, or stuff that we don't know about that fills some of the needs we talked about? We'd love to hear about it.
I agree with that. And now, if you're following us here, you can follow us on YouTube. You can follow us on Twitter. You can also follow us on Twitch now, and we have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites, YouTube and Twitter and Twitch now.
Yep.
We are live every other Sunday at 1 p.m., but even better, next week, and this is the July 4th, 2019 weekend, we should be attempting a live cast gaming for 4 days straight, starting probably Thursday night, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Barring breaks for dinner, we will be having a game at Paul's place with our friends. So feel free to tune in when you get a chance and see how we run our games on either YouTube or Twitch at Wandering DMs for the big July 4th holiday. And we'll look forward to seeing you then and seeing what you think about our gaming. And we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah. Hope to see you then.